From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, rescuing Bing Crosby from the image of the square old man. We talk with jazz critic Gary Giddens about how Crosby changed American singing and popular culture. Giddens' biography of Crosby covers his career in the 1920s and 30s, before he became a middle-of-the-road crooner. The book is now out in paperback. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Frida, about the Mexican painter Frida Kahlo. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There's been a breakthrough in the labor dispute involving longshoremen and transport companies on the West Coast. NPR's Elaine Corey reports from San Francisco.
The Longshore Union and the shipping lines have reached a tentative agreement on what had been their major dispute, the introduction of new cargo tracking technology to the ports. The union maintained it did not oppose the technology itself, but it wanted to keep control of the jobs created by it. Federal mediator Peter Hertgen announced the breakthrough came after all-night negotiations. He gave no details, saying they would not be released until there was a final agreement between the parties. Negotiations broke down in late September, leading to a 10-day lockout of the dock workers by the shipping companies. The longshore workers are still digging out from the backlog that was created. Elaine Corey, NPR News, San Francisco.
A federal judge in Washington has approved most of the provisions of an antitrust settlement that was reached earlier this year among Microsoft, the Justice Department, and nine states. The judge rejected arguments from nine other states that wanted the giant software maker to face much stiffer penalties for trying to suppress its competition. The settlement would require Microsoft to make it easier for its competitors to design software that will work with the Windows operating system. Microsoft says it has already made most of the required changes. Police in Rockville, Maryland, say they've connected the Washington-area sniper suspects to a shooting that left a liquor store employee wounded in mid-September. If the connection is proven, it would mean the shooting attacks in the Washington area began about 2 weeks earlier than previously thought. John Allen Muhammad and John Lee Malvo are now suspects in murders in five states and the District of Columbia. Police say the suspects contacted authorities a number of times. A newly released tape details one of those run-ins. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The tape was recorded by police in Rockville, Maryland, a separate department from the Montgomery County Police, which led the investigation into the Washington area shootings. On the tape, obtained by ABC News, the caller refers to a tarot card left at the scene of the shooting of a 13-year-old boy and asks that negotiations be started.
Look on the tarot card. It says, "Call me God. Do not release the press. We have called you three times before, trying to set up negotiations. We've got no response. People have died."
The 911 operator told the caller to phone a different number, a hotline police set up. FBI Director Robert Mueller says it's clear investigators need to figure out how to better handle the large number of telephone tips in big cases. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow gained 120 points or 1.4% to close at 85.17. The Nasdaq gained 31 points. This is NPR News. Emergency officials say 29 people were killed in yesterday's powerful earthquake in southern Italy, including almost an entire class of first graders. The authorities say they've confirmed that there are no more bodies in the rubble of the school. The quake struck a region about 50 miles north of Naples yesterday morning as the children celebrated Halloween. Rescuers found the last survivor, a 9-year-old boy, early this morning. The Italian government estimated that about 70% of the homes in the area were damaged, leaving about 3,000 people homeless. The South Dakota Attorney General's office is planning to file forgery charges against a woman who gathered absentee ballot applications on or near the state's Indian reservations. Brian Bull reports from South Dakota Public Radio.
Attorney General Mark Barnett says investigators have reviewed Becky Redearth-Valeda's activities across 25 counties and believe she may have forged voters' names on up to 1,000 absentee ballot applications. Redearth-Valeda had been hired by the state Democratic Party, but was fired after a county auditor found several falsified signatures in her paperwork. In a letter, Redearth-Valeda admits to signing other people's names to the applications, but says it was done to make sure absentee ballots were sent to the right address. The investigation highlights the importance of the Native American vote in South Dakota, which could decide the outcome of several tight political races, particularly the contest between incumbent Democratic Senator Tim Johnson and Republican challenger John Thune. For NPR News, I'm Brian Bull in Vermilion, South Dakota.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 15 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from The Entrepreneur Source, offering self-employment options, franchising information, education, and training on the web at franchisesearch.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. For many of us who grew up in the rock and roll era, Bing Crosby epitomized square, middle-of-the-road singing. His TV specials in the 1960s were hopelessly old-fashioned, and his movie career by then was behind him. But when Crosby started out as a vocalist in the 1920s, he represented something new. His sound was jazzy and witty, and whether he was performing solo or teaming with other gifted singers, Crosby's recordings always were fluid and playful. Jazz critic Gary Giddens goes so far as to call Crosby the most influential and successful popular performer of the first half of the 20th century. Giddens has completed the first volume of a two-part biography of Crosby, and it's just out in paperback. It explains how Crosby changed American singing and pop culture. The book begins in 1903, the year of Crosby's birth, and ends in 1940, the year of his first road movie with Bob Hope. You may remember Gary Giddens as one of the enthusiastic commentators from the Ken Burns Jazz series on PBS. He's also the author of books about Louis Armstrong and Charlie Parker, and won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his book Visions of Jazz. Terry spoke with Giddens earlier this year when his book was published in hardback.
Gary, would you choose a Crosby song for us, an early song, that you think helps illustrate how he changed American singing?
How about Some of These Days?
And why are you choosing it?
Well, he did it fairly early in his career as a soloist in the early 30s. It's with a jazz group in Chicago. And it gives a good example of the way he used swing and how advanced a scat singer he was and how hip he was into jazz, because he quotes a Beiderbecke phrase in his scat solo. And there's a lot of good players on this record, but Crosby outclasses them all.
This is Bing Crosby.
Some of these days you're gonna miss me, honey. Some of these days you're gonna be so lonely. You miss my hugging, gonna miss my kissing. You be so sorry when I'm away. Now you're gonna be lonely just for me only. 'Cause you know, honey, that you had your way. And when you leave me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You'll miss your little daddy some of these days. Ha da dee da dee da dee dee da 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 dee 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 da 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 dee dee da 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 dee 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 da 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 dee 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 da 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 dee 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 da 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 dee 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 da 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 da.
That's one of Bing Crosby's recordings from the early 30s. My guest, Gary Giddens, has written a new biography of Crosby. Gary, one of the things you're doing in this book is rescuing Crosby from the image of the square old man. In what ways did he transform popular singing? What was it before him? What do you think he helped change it to?
He radically changed pop singing. You know, if you listen to a couple of the really early Crosby records, they might not sound as startling today as, for example, Armstrong's first great vocal record, Heebie Jeebies. They both started recording vocals around the same time, Armstrong 1 year earlier. But if you listen to Bing's, say, Muddy Water from 1926 in tandem with all of the best-selling vocal records of that year, it's astonishing how different he is. For the most part, singers in that period were tenors. They often used a kind of semi-falsetto style. They deliberately tried to sound effeminate. This was a great period for gender bending. The most popular star in vaudeville was a transvestite named Julian Eltinge, who was so popular that a Broadway theater was named after him. And male singers often sang in that high, kind of flowery way. They did not sing to emphasize the meaning of lyrics. Crosby was really the first to do that. In part because they were encouraged by song pluggers to be as bland as possible so as to simply sell the song and the sheet music. With Crosby, it no longer became about the song, it became about the singer. Crosby was the first white singer to really understand what Louis Armstrong was about. He was completely transfixed by Armstrong when they first met in 1926 in Chicago. He understood swing instantly. His time was extraordinary. And he was a baritone, a deep-voiced, virile baritone who really made you hear the lyric. And because he had such an intimate style, he created a kind of erotic edge that did not exist in popular singing before him.
Why were most male singers tenors in that period, whereas Crosby was a baritone? Why so many tenors?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I think that the tenor style first became popular, actually going back to minstrelsy, when there was usually a tenor solo. But for one reason, tenors' voices hang clearer in theaters without amplification. They're more easily heard. And when the technology came in, when radio started, radio was more conducive to baritones, deeper voices, more nuance. So in a sense, the new technology, both electrical recording, the condenser microphone, and radio technology all were helpful to Crosby's style and made the baritone ultimately the dominant singer. In fact, except for Tony Bennett and, I guess, Elvis, it's hard to think of a major American popular singer of the last 70 years who isn't a baritone, while it's impossible to think of any singer before then who wasn't a tenor, from Al Jolson on down.
Crosby was known as a crooner, largely because he used a microphone. He didn't have to rely on a big projecting kind of voice. He's one of the first of the singers to successfully use the microphone and develop that style of singing. Did he actively want to use a microphone? Was this something he was really excited about, or was he just in the right place at the right time?
No, he understood the value of the microphone instantly. He began occasionally holding a megaphone, like many singers of that period. But audiences didn't like to see the megaphone because it obscured his face. So, and he had a problem projecting in larger theaters, especially when he got to New York. So when the microphone was taken out of the radio studio and out of the recording studio and finally created in such a way as that it could be used on a stage, he instantly took to it. But his real gift for the microphone began when he was working at the Coconut Grove, and even before that, actually, at the Club Montmartre in the late 20s in Los Angeles. And the audiences were just stunned at the way he would use the microphone. He almost as though it were a musical instrument. He knew instantly how to use them so that he wouldn't be too sibilant, or so that he could use dynamics. He could be loud. He could be soft. And he really altered his style in a sense when he realized he did not have to be stentorian. He did not have to hit the rafters or the last row in the balcony. And it changed his style, and it subsequently changed the style of popular singing.
Why don't we listen to Bing Crosby's debut recording? Why don't you introduce it for us? Tell us what's happening here, when he recorded it.
Well, this is Muddy Water from late 1926.
This is Paul Whiteman, the band leader.
Paul Whiteman was playing at the Million Dollar Theater in California when Bing and his partner Al Rinker were doing a vaudeville show. And a couple of the guys from Whiteman's band went to hear him and came back raving to Paul. Whiteman had been looking for some jazz talent. He was known as the king of jazz, but he had no jazz musicians. And he was looking for someone, and they recommended Crosby. And he signed them, actually, without hearing them. He invited them into his dressing room and signed the contract. Then he had them meet him in Chicago, and for the first few recording sessions, they mostly disappeared into a kind of choir of vocalists, musicians in the band who doubled as singers. But then finally, he gave Crosby his first solo on Muddy Water, which is an interesting song in that it was written by an integrated team, a white composer and a black lyricist. And lyrically, it's basically a typical idyl about the South down Dixie way, as part of the lyric goes. But right away, you can hear Bing's superb time, and the way he articulates, his enunciation was incredible. This is a guy who, you know, he's the only major figure in popular singing who had a full classical education. He won all kinds of elocution and debating awards, and that served him well as a singer. You can also hear he was enormously influenced from his earliest years by Al Jolson. He loved Jolson as well as he loved Armstrong and John McCormick, the Irish tenor, and many other performers. And you can always, in the early records especially, hear those influences kind of vying with each other. And every once in a while in Muddy Water, he will make a certain a word trill a little bit, and you can hear that Jolson impact. But at the same time, you can appreciate that he's opening up a window into the future and something very new is happening here.
Okay, here's Bing Crosby's recording debut with Paul Whiteman.
Muddy water around my feet, muddy water in the street, just God's own shelter down on the delta. Muddy water in my shoes, rocking to those low-down blues. They live in ease and comfort down there, I declare. Been away a year today to wander and roam. I don't care, it's muddy there, but still it's my home. Got my toes turned Dixie way, round that delta let me lay. My heart cries out for muddy water.
That was Bing Crosby's recording debut, made in 1927. We correct ourselves, it wasn't 1926.
Right.
And that was with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Gary, you mentioned his being influenced by Al Jolson. Were Jolson and Crosby rivals?
Oh, no. Jolson was much older than Crosby. He was a huge star. He was a star when Crosby was born. Bing started listening to his records in his early childhood, and was just knocked out by them. And then when Bing was about 14, Jolson came to Spokane, and Bing got a job backstage and got to see him and watched his every performance and just, as he said, hung on every word and every movement. And so he just adored Jolson as a performer. And I think it was seeing Jolson that sort of made him contemplate becoming an entertainer in the first place. The interesting thing about his relationship with Jolson is that by the 1940s, when Crosby was, you know, beyond superstardom, he was the most popular, beloved performer in the world, Jolson had some very bad years, and he made his comeback on Crosby's radio show. And there was a complete reversal, because now Crosby was the one who had influenced Jolson. He had showed him how to kind of lower his wattage when he was in a recording studio so that he could sing ballads and not, you know, tear the microphones apart. And most people today remember as Jolson's greatest period as a singer, his period from the late 1940s. The earlier records, the ones that made him famous in the teens and 1920s, are fairly difficult to listen to now because they're so theatrical and they don't have that sense of dynamics that you need for a recording studio.
Jazz critic Gary Giddens speaking with Terry Gross. He's written a new biography of Bing Crosby, now out in paperback. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. He's talking about his new biography of Bing Crosby, the first volume of which is now out in paperback.
One of the things you find so interesting about Bing Crosby is the way he manages to bring together different strains of American singing, from jazz to minstrelsy, vaudeville, ethnic singing, Irish singing. His father had one of the early Edison phonographs when Crosby was still in grade school. What kind of music did you find out was in the Crosby family collection when Bing was growing up?
Well, he bought, you have to understand that the phonograph was so new and so novel, and he had one of the first in Spokane, that every record, anything that you could get to play on it, was valued, and every record was a mystery until you played it. So Crosby grew up in a period, as did Armstrong, when there were no prejudices about what was hip and what was not hip, what was Mickey Mouse, what was, you know, cool in and out. All that stuff just didn't exist then. They wanted to hear everything. And so we had all of the Irish tenors. His father loved John McCormick and Dennis Sullivan and a lot of singers like that. They had Caruso. They had comedy records. Cone on the Telephone was a million-selling comedy record in the turn of the century. They had, as eventually they replaced the cylinder player with a more sophisticated machine that played lateral discs. And by that time, you started to get the jazz bands as of 1917 when Bing was 14 years old. And he immediately gravitated to those. But he listened to everything and absorbed all those performers. And, of course, there were a lot of Jolson records in the house and a lot of vaudeville performers. After he met Mildred Bailey, he listened a lot to Ethel Waters, Bessie Smith, McKinney's Cotton Pickers, Six Brown Brothers, which was a saxophone group, just Ukulele Ike. He had a lot of Ukulele Ike's records.
Bing Crosby went to college, studied law, and it was while he was studying law that he bought a set of drums through a mail order catalog, and that really changed his life. Why did he buy a set of drums, and what connection did it make for him?
He was playing in the school band and with a bunch of high school kids, and he'd been saving up. He worked like a dog. I mean, I go into some detail about all the jobs he had. Just unbelievable. I mean, 6 in the morning, he'd be working in a skid row place cleaning up after alcoholics, and then he'd first go on a newspaper route, and then he'd manage to be at Mass all before his first class. And he saved up his money, and he ordered the set of drums with the palm tree on the bass drum and the gooseneck cymbal attached to it. And there was a guy, a high school kid. Bing was in college at this point, and there was a high school kid named Al Rinker who was at a different neighborhood of Spokane. And he had put together a little group of musicians, and they had just fired their drummer because he couldn't keep time. And somebody said, there's this guy at Gonzaga who just bought his own set. So Rinker called him up, introduced himself, said that he had a band. Would he like to come over to the house with his drums and for rehearsal? So Bing said, sure. He carried the drums over. And now Bing at this point is like 21 years old, and these are a bunch of 17-year-olds, and it didn't bother him in the least. And they had this first rehearsal, and he loved it. They all were very excited about the sound. They liked the way Bing kept the beat. And after the first number, Bing was so delighted with it, he said, I can also sing. And he reached into his drum case and pulled out a tiny little megaphone as if to prove the point. And when they heard him sing, they thought, wow, this is incredible. They've got a drummer and a singer now. And the band was called the Musicalators. And they worked for about a year in Spokane.
Then Al Rinker and Bing Crosby ended up joining the Paul Whiteman Band, and then with the addition of the songwriter and singer Harry Barris, they became known as the Rhythm Boys.
Right.
What kind of act did they work up together?
Well, the first piece that they did was Mississippi Mud, and that was hugely successful. And it's funny, when you talk to people today who were alive then, and I interviewed quite a few, everybody remembers Mississippi Mud. Basically, it was a comedy musical act. They all loved comedy. Crosby, of course, was that was one of the things he admired about Jolson. And then, of course, when he saw Armstrong in Chicago, that was the other thing. I mean, here was this genius musician who would stop the show and do comedy routines. Armstrong would reach in the back and pull out a deacon's coat and put it on and a pair of glasses on his nose and introduce himself as the Reverend Satchel Mouth and do, you know, parodies. And the idea that you could mix comedy and music was very appealing to Crosby. They would do dance steps. They would do imitations, all kinds of things. But basically, they worked up, on records anyway, a very basic approach to harmonizing, with Bing singing the solos. Harry Barris would kind of vocalize a cymbal-like sound, a pa, to kind of keep the rhythm going and sort of exclamatory points in the performances. I think the greatest record of the Rhythm Boys, at least my favorite, was a thing called The Bluebirds and the Blackbirds Got Together, which is basically a song about integration and very much ahead of its time. And it's a good example of how well they meshed, not only singing together, but just improvising one-liners and talking to each other and just throwing in little verbal fillips throughout the performance.
Well, why don't we hear it?
My doorstep, a look at my doorstep, a look at the bluebirds, a look at the blackbirds, a look at the good luck, a look at the bad luck, a look at the good luck and the bad luck there. Whip. Never saw bluebirds mingle with blackbirds, and never saw bluebirds doing these backwards, and never knew good luck ever could perch with care. Now I overheard those birdies talking today, and I know just why they're acting this way.
Now first the bluebird said, we've got to have sunny weather. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. Then the blackbird said, we're birds of a different feather. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. And when they talked it over, they let the blackbirds bring rain, and then the bluebirds all agreed to bring that sunshine again. For we can't have rain or sunshine that lasts forever. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together.
Trouble, trouble round my door. Blackbirds, blackbirds by the score. Bluebirds, bluebirds came one day and said to the blackbirds, hear our say.
First off,
jazz critic Gary Giddens speaking with Terry Gross. Bing Crosby, A Pocket Full of Dreams, the first of a two-volume biography, has just come out in paperback. We'll talk more about Bing in the second half of the show. Sitting in for Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By DK Publishing, publisher of Bill Wyman's Rolling with the Stones, the inside story of the rock and roll band told by a man who can tell it like it was. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about Bing Crosby with his biographer, jazz critic Gary Giddens. His book about the singer is now out in paperback. And David Edelstein reviews the new film Frida, starring Salma Hayek and Alfred Molina. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, back with more of Terry's conversation with jazz critic Gary Giddens. The first volume in his two-part biography of Bing Crosby is now out in paperback. It's called Bing Crosby, A Pocketful of Dreams, The Early Years, 1903 to 1940. Giddens describes Crosby as the most influential and successful popular performer in the first half of the 20th century. Here's a sample of one of Crosby's early recordings. From 1927, this is Mary, featuring Paul Whiteman and his orchestra, with Bix Beiderbecke on cornet.
What are you waiting for? What are you waiting for, Mary? What are you thinking about? Who are you thinking about, Mary? The bees are buzzing, they're buzzing right in my ear. And they keep on asking, hey, what's the big idea? Think of the moon above, doesn't it speak of love, Mary? Why do you leave me on? Why do you be so contrary? You wouldn't let my castles come tumbling down. Think of the things in store, what are you waiting for, Mary?
What do you think playing with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra exposed Crosby to in terms of musical venues and musical styles?
The whole experience with Whiteman was an education. And for the first of all, it took him around the country. Until he was, 22, he had never been outside of the state of Washington, hardly been outside Spokane. And then he toured vaudeville, but that was all in California, from San Diego up to San Francisco. Whiteman took him from throughout the Midwest into New York. When he got to New York, he was exposed to Duke Ellington, Ethel Waters, all these incredible bands, uptown, midtown, and he drank it all in. He spent all of his nights in Harlem going from one club to another, hanging out at jam sessions. He roomed for a while with Bix Beiderbecke, who became a very close friend, and they spent a lot of time together at speakeasies, and they also were at jam sessions in New York and Chicago. Whenever they hit Chicago, and later on in New York as well, he would look up Louis Armstrong. And he began to just take to the whole fast life of that period. I mean, he was a poster boy for Prohibition, and that Prohibition was the unenforceable law that everybody felt an obligation to flaunt. And so he became quite a heavy drinker, and he really took in the exciting nightlife of that period. He went to all the shows he could. He met all kinds of famous personalities like Maurice Chevalier and Ravel, and heard every kind of music that was available, and there wasn't much that wasn't available in New York in those days.
Sounds like he became a marijuana user, too.
He smoked some pot, I think probably began with Armstrong, and although I don't think he smoked it in later years, he did advocate its legalization right up to the end. Now, of course, it was legal when he was, you know, until the 1930s, so in that period, you know, it wasn't that big a deal.
Well, let's hear another track that I think helps illustrate how music was changing and how Crosby was helping to change it. And this is another Rhythm Boys track, and this is another track with Paul Whiteman. It's from Monday On, and it's Crosby and Al Rinker with another singer named Austin Skin Young.
Right.
And it starts with a real barbershop quartet kind of sound, the old sound, and then kind of segues into this kind of new, fun, scat singing kind of sound.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit more about this track?
It's not even barbershop. It's just so typical of that gender-bending tenor quality. The first voice, as I recall, is a kind of falsetto, every day is what? And it just, you know, it's so dated, and you think, oh, my God, what are we listening to here? And then right away, the Rhythm Boys come in and double the tempo. The idea of the arrangement was to use all the singers in Whiteman's band, which was to use the tenor trio, which consisted of musicians doubling as this very poor singers for the most part, and then the Rhythm Boys, and play one against the other. And then Crosby comes in for the solo, and here's a good example where you can just see it's night and day between Bing and all the other voices on the track.
Okay, this is Bing Crosby.
Also, I should just mention that it has a wonderful trumpet solo by the great Bix Beiderbecke.
Okay, let's hear it.
Every day was blue. Oh.
On Monday, because it's wash day, and we'll wash our blues away. From Monday on, the skies will look bright. Don't tell me different, I know I'm right. I'm gonna start shouting, hey, hey, when he says love, honor, and obey, cause I'll be happy from Monday on.
From Monday On, recorded in 1928 with Bing Crosby as one of the rhythm boys with Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. How did Crosby end up becoming a solo singer?
The guys in Whiteman's band, Whiteman's band consisted of several cliques. The older clique wanted to continue playing the music that Whiteman had become famous for, which was dance band music. The younger guys in the band, the jazz fans, they wanted the band to go more in the direction of the genuine jazz players that he began to hire in 1927, 1928. The jazz guys loved Crosby. They were constantly lobbying Whiteman to give Crosby more solos. The jazz arrangers, Bill Challis preeminent among them, wanted to write all of his pieces for Crosby and for Beiderbecke. He didn't like the older players, and this caused tremendous dissension in the band, and actually it caused two of Whiteman's biggest stars and oldest friends to leave the band because basically they were jealous. Crosby eventually had all kinds of arguments with the band. He was late. Whiteman penalized him for over a drinking incident and some other things, and they were just at loggerheads, and at some point they just decided to have a break, and the contract was basically torn up, and they began to work as a group, the Rhythm Boys, and weren't having much luck. And then they went back to Hollywood, and after a while got this incredible engagement at the Coconut Grove, which didn't pay them very much, but it made them hugely popular with the movie colony. And instantly, Bing Crosby was accepted into that world.
Into the movie world.
Yeah.
Jazz critic Gary Giddens speaking with Terry Gross. He's written a new biography of Bing Crosby, now out in paperback. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. He's talking about his new biography of Bing Crosby, the first volume of which is now out in paperback.
How does Crosby's singing change once he goes out on his own?
A number of things happened. In the late 20s, early 30s, he had a very appealing, slight gravel to his voice. It was caused by nodes on his vocal cords, and in fact, when he was insured by Paramount with Lloyd's of London, a proviso in the contract was that he could never have surgery to remove the nodes because they thought he would lose the vocal quality that made him so famous and popular on the radio. But by taking care of himself and keeping quiet for a short while, the nodes began to recede. So his voice changed, and in place of that hoarseness, there was a brand new clarity and brilliance that really comes into a peak in the mid and late 1930s, which I think in some ways is his greatest period as a singer. And at the same time, thanks in part to his producer, Jack Capp, who created Decca Records, he was being encouraged to lose the mannerisms. Now, one of the things Crosby brought to pop singing that was so important was that he got rid of almost immediately of all the Rococo mannerisms that characterized singers when he was coming up. He really focused on the lyric, what the lyric meant. He focused on the clean melodic line, which is why he was so appealing to songwriters who loved writing songs for him. But as he matured in the 30s, he got even more spare in his style and was just very, very clear in hitting every note. Pitch was always right. His improvisations were still often ingenious, but they were subtler. And as he got older, he became more and more laid back in his style, more cool. Sometimes he sounded as though he were phoning in performances, and very often, especially in the 40s when he was recording almost, you know, daily, he was phoning them in. But by that time, he was so much the professional that you couldn't always tell, because he learned those songs, he had an audiographic memory, he heard it once, he knew the song, and rarely made mistakes. When he makes mistakes, audiences loved when he made mistakes, especially on the radio, because it was so unusual to hear that from him.
Let's hear a recording that was a turning point in Crosby's career, and this is Just One More Chance. What does this signify in his career?
This was a song that was written expressly for him by Sam Coslow and his partner. And it was a huge hit. It wasn't, as I say in the book, it wasn't quite Heartbreak Hotel, but it was a turning point because it brought Crosby out of the jazz milieu, out of the jazz cult, and into the mainstream. And tens of thousands of people who didn't know Crosby before got to know him because of this record, which he incidentally used on his very first radio broadcast.
And where is he in terms of the development of his singing style on this recording?
This is very early. He's only been a soloist on his own now for about a year, and or I don't know, maybe a couple of years, and he's still trying to figure out what his style is. This is a period when his recordings fluctuate tremendously. Sometimes he's rather mannered. Sometimes he'll try some kind of a melismatic gimmick. Other times he's swinging away at jazz. Other times he's doing fairly lacrimose ballads. He's really trying to figure out who he is and define, codify what his style is going to be. And this is one of those breakthrough records where you can hear the Crosby cry, the sob, the intimate approach to lyrics that was just so... it just knocked the audiences out.
So this is Bing Crosby, recorded in 1931.
Just one more chance to prove it's you alone I care for. Each night I say a little prayer for. Just one more chance. Just one more night to taste the kisses that enchant me. I'd want no others if you'd grant me just one more chance. I've learned the meaning of repentance. Now you're the jury at my trial. I know that I should serve my sentence. Still, I'm hoping all the while you'll give me just one more word. I said that I was glad to start out.
That's Bing Crosby, recorded in 1931. My guest, Gary Giddens, has written a new biography of Crosby called Pocketful of Dreams, and it covers his early years through 1940. Volume 2 of this biography is in the works. This recording is one of the recordings that helped make Crosby a star. How did fame affect him?
One of the reasons that audiences so loved Crosby is because fame didn't seem to affect him very much at all. He so obviously loved his good fortune. He loved the money. He loved the sporting life that he was leading, that audiences could enjoy it vicariously with him throughout the Depression. Nobody was envious of Crosby. No matter how much wealth he accrued, he seemed to be the same basic guy. And in most respects, he was. I mean, for example, he never missed Mass. One thing that did change is he stopped drinking. With the beginning of his film career, he just turned around completely. But even when he was a drunk, he always went to Mass, and that never stopped. In his later years, his butler described him to me as being on his knees every night in front of the bed before he went to sleep. He was always doing something. He was constantly occupied. So the older Crosby, the rich Crosby, the famous Crosby, is not that unlike the young Crosby that the Jesuits had by the small hairs in Spokane.
Are you looking forward to writing volume two of this, or were you so much more interested in the early stuff that volume two is going to be comparatively difficult to get through?
No, on the contrary, I thought that Road to Singapore was a true ending for the first volume. It just seemed to me to end that story. But to me, the greatest story of all about Crosby is 1946. That's the peak year of his career. It's the year when he single-handedly turned radio from a live medium into a canned medium, financed the invention and production of tape and tape recorders, and just turned the industry around. That's a story I've always wanted to tell, and it will be central to the second volume.
Well, I look forward to you telling it. And thank you so much for talking with us about Bing
Thank
Crosby.
Thank you, Terry.
Gary Giddens is the author of Bing Crosby, A Pocketful of Dreams, The Early Years, 1903 to 1940. It's just been published in paperback. Volume 2 is in the works. Giddens describes Crosby as the first white singer to assimilate the genius of Louis Armstrong. Here's Armstrong and Crosby together in 1956 from the film High Society.
Listen to, well, you know who. Say, hey, Pops, you want to grab a little of what's left here?
Yeah, Daddy, yeah.
Here we go. If you sail,
I sailing
over the sea.
Oh, will you wait for me?
Take my tip, they're all molded hip in Italy.
Oh, well, Avaraduce, as for France.
Oh, I know you're very big there.
Yes, believe it or not.
I do believe, I do indeed.
The Frenchman's all free for what they call les jazz high.
Pull me down, take a plane.
Oh, Babadouzat.
Go to Siam.
The long-awaited film biography of Mexican painter Frida Kahlo is now in theaters. It's directed by puppeteer and designer Julie Taymor, who created The Lion King on Broadway. Salma Hayek stars as Frida, and Alfred Molina plays Diego Rivera. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
For her new biographical movie about the Mexican painter Frida Kahlo, Julie Taymor has a visual idea that's thrilling. She also has a visual idea that's crippling. Guess what? It's the same idea. It's to treat Frida as a figure in a Frida Kahlo painting. Thanks to some of the most exquisite special effects you'll ever see, flat paintings suddenly acquire three dimensions, and three-dimensional people freeze and become part of a canvas. Frida is rich in folk art colors and brainy spectacle and breezy soap opera. By the standards of its shallow genre, the biopic, it's something of a triumph. If you want to know why Frida Kahlo is more than a painter, she's an icon, a mass culture phenomenon, a cottage industry, then look no further. Taymor, as they say, prints the legend. Here is the breathless Mexican student, played by Salma Hayek, shattered in a bus crash, and Taymor serves up a sacred yet ghastly image of the young woman splayed out, impaled, covered in bright red blood and gold dust that was meant for a cathedral ceiling. Frida wakes to a chilling Day of the Dead skeleton show of doctors and nurses, animated by the great film surrealists, the Brothers Quay. Her wedding ceremony to the muralist Diego Rivera is just as Kahlo painted it, and when she's stricken over the breakup of their marriage, after she has caught Diego having sex with her sister, the image is from her famous self-portrait with cropped hair. Again and again, the seminal events in Frida's life are seen through the prism of her artistry. You ask, what's wrong with that? Only that life and art are not the same, and making them bleed so thoroughly into each other has a way of minimizing the artistic process. Kahlo was enormously canny and resourceful in taking traditional folk art and miracle paintings known as retablos, and transforming them into mythic visions of her own physical pain and emotional dislocation. Here, those visions seem to leap fully formed from her imagination, we never even see her paint. As Frida, Selma Hayek has such a lithe and wriggly little body and is so revved up and raring to go that she doesn't convey much of the ugly physical paralysis of Frida's life. And there's something twittery about her voice that reminds me of Penelope Cruz. But she's terrifically game, and I came to like her. Even better is Alfred Molina, who brings a wonderful lightness to the fat Rivera. Molina creates a figure of titanic irresponsibility, a creature of impulse with no obligation to reconcile his political and personal ideals. Here he is proposing a passionate but unorthodox marriage to Frida after their first night together.
We'll have to get married, you know.
What?
The thing is, I think it's quite possible that we were born for each other.
But you don't believe in marriage.
Of course I do. I've had two wives already.
Exactly. You can't be true to only one woman.
True, yes. Faithful. No. Unfortunately, I'm physiologically incapable of fidelity.
Oh, really?
Yes, a doctor acquaintance of mine confirmed this.
What a convenient diagnosis.
Is fidelity that important to you?
Loyalty is important to me. Can you be loyal?
To you? Always.
That distinction between fidelity and loyalty is a little blurry to me, since both Frida and Diego end up taking scores of lovers. By the time the two separate, the movie has become sketchy and diffuse, symptoms of most Hollywood biopics, which tend to skip lightly along the surface of their subjects' lives. Reportedly, there was pressure from the studio Miramax to put the emphasis on flashy spectacle. And certainly one reason that Frida runs out of narrative steam is that it strives to put such a life-affirming spin on the material. The last act of Kahlo's life was actually marked by drug and alcohol addiction, a decline in artistic power, and a desperate embrace of Stalin. But Frida the movie is never allowed to bog down or to show how fiercely difficult it was for Kahlo to bridge the distance between her personal agony and her art. Frida is a marvelous slideshow of a movie, but as a portrait of the artist as a tormented human being, it's all on the surface.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate. Coming up, we remember Jam Master Jay of the rap group Run DMC. This is Fresh Air. Jam Master Jay, the DJ for the rap group Run DMC, was shot and killed Wednesday night at age 37. His real name was Jason Mizell, and he was a key player in the early days of rap and hip-hop. Run DMC was the first rap group to have its videos played on MTV. The video for their high-energy duet with Aerosmith, Walk This Way, showed them literally breaking down the walls between rock and rap, which is just what their music did. Run-DMC was the first rap group to make the cover of Rolling Stone. They sang playfully about basketball, fast food, and sneakers. Although Jason Mizell never appeared on Fresh Air, the co-founder of Run-DMC, Daryl McDaniels, spoke to Terry in 1997 about the formation of the group.
You're from Hollis, Queens.
Yes.
In New York, and the two other members of Run-DMC are from the same neighborhood, I think.
Yes.
And you went to school together, right? You knew each other before you were a group.
Yeah, definitely. We all lived in 5 blocks of each other. We went to elementary and high school and college together.
So when did you actually form Run-DMC? Where were you in your school years?
Well, me and Run first started rhyming and DJing together in my basement. I actually taught Run how to DJ. He was rapping first, then I taught him how to DJ, how to do the quick mix, and how to spin records back, and how to blend two of the same records together. So Run DMC was like formed back in 1980. We started DJing in my basement, and then when he got better equipment to me for Christmas, so we started DJing in his attic. So I would say Run-DMC was formed right then. And then as the group, it was 1982 when we put together It's Like That and That's the Way It Is as Sucker MCs, which was our first single. And then we needed a DJ, and that's when we got Jam Master Jay, who was the neighborhood DJ. He was like the best DJ in the neighborhood. Jay would set up his equipment in the park, and he'd plug it in into the light post, and then we would play until a cops would come and stop us. So actually, we came together as a professional group in 1982.
And were you in high school and college?
We was all in college. We was all in our first semester of college.
Did you leave college once you started performing?
Yep, we took a leave of absence and been absent ever since.
Terry Gross speaking with Daryl McDaniels in 1997 about his bandmate, Jam Master Jay. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacourt Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, the debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the human response and the technical challenge of deconstructing the World Trade Center. A talk with William Longavisha, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly and author of the new book, American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. Join us for the next Fresh Air.